Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Certified Forgotten. That's right. There is the best, still the best, in horror films with 10 or fewer reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. That is our lane. That is our shtick. That is the niche that we hope to occupy as film critics. And we're really excited that you're turning in for an episode because clearly you have excellent taste and clearly you appreciate the finer and rarer things in life, such as very, very small, very, very underwatched horror cinema. My name is Matt Monagle. I am one half of your Matt hosts. I am joined, as always, by my friend and partner in crime, Matt Donato. How are you doing, Donato?
We're doing okay. A little sniffly. I think I had allergies again. I don't know how that works, but I moved to LA and like they went away and now they're back. Life's weird.
Oh, congratulations. I did not have any kind of seasonal allergies until I moved to Austin. And I think that I've started to develop them over the last couple of years. Which everybody says you were going to because of all the cedar, because they base something about like they only have male trees and so they just dump pollen everywhere, but there's nothing else. I can't remember. They write an article about it once every year in like the Austin Statesman.
In like the East Coast, the winter allergies were the ones that got me. And then I moved here. I'm like, cool, there's no winter. I can avoid them. And I was clean for a while. And yeah, now I get the springtime ones. So just, I guess life always finds a way or some shit. I don't know. There's a quote in there somewhere.
You were clean and then you fell off the wagon and went right back to that sweet, sweet allergy, huh?
God, I hate it. Why couldn't it be anything else but that?
I hear you. Well, hey, normally this would be the part of the episode where I would say, Mr. Donato, please introduce this week's lovely guest. But we don't have a guest. And there's a pretty good reason for that. We're using this episode as sort of a pivot, as sort of a gentle transition to kind of a new thing that we're going to be doing. It's not going to replace the episodes that you know and love. But Donato and I have been kicking around some ideas about, you know, working a few additional movies, maybe movies that don't fall under our super strict 10 Rotten Tomato reviews or fewer criteria. But we know there's a lot of movies that we would like to talk about on the podcast. We know that there are a lot of movies that you'd probably like to hear us talk about on the podcast. And we recognize that Certified Forgotten is a spirit, you know, it is a spiritual experience, not necessarily a physical one. So we think we can futz it up a little bit. So we don't have a guest this week, Donato. It's going to be a regular podcast episode for all intents and purposes, except it's just the two of us.
Yeah, and we won't do this super often with the regular episodes, just to confirm. Regular episodes will continue moving forward as planned. It's going to be every other week, and we're going to have our guests on. We're going to do fun things. And I'm not going to lie, I did propose the idea of doing a Monagle and Donato episode of a regular episode because we've never done one. We always have people on. We always talk to them about the movies they bring. But I have a list, honestly, of movies that qualify for the podcast just in case people want some help. Yeah, so Monagle does as well. And there's some movies on there that I know no one else is going to champion. So I kind of do find it a little bit endearing and a little bit, I think, okay. I think we're allowed to maybe take one episode every few years. And I picked this one because I wanted to champion the movie we're going to talk about and we'll get to later. But yeah, into what Monagle's talking, in addition to what we are doing, we're going to try throwing in some side episodes to talk about maybe more popular stuff and maybe things that will actually track and get noticed by algorithms on the internet instead of movies with 10 or less reviews no one's talking about.
It's true. You know, we often joke about the fact that Certified Forgotten isn't a great business model. And, you know, to unpack that joke a little bit, there's a couple of different ways you can grow an audience, right? As a journalist or as a content creator online, one of them is growing the audience because people really like you. They follow you where you go. They're introduced to you through your work and here, there, and other places. And when you guest on podcasts, people follow you and go check out other podcast episodes that you've already done. That's very true. That is a great way to do it. But another thing that we can do, and especially I think important when you run a film podcast, is the notion that people want to talk or to hear people talk about the movies that they just watched. I'm at home, I'm on Tubi, I'm watching something like under the bed for myself. And you know, what I want to be able to hear is I want to hear people talk about that movie. And that's fine for some of the like the smaller stuff. You know, obviously we love and the thing we often talk about on the podcast, the thing that there need to be people out there that are creating demand, not just meeting demand, right? Like that's still a very, very important thing that we're going to do going forward. But there are a lot of movies that have a lot more search volume, a lot more people are looking to talk about them that we still think fit the criteria of a Certified Forgotten film, if not in that 10 or fewer threshold, then certainly in all the ways that matter. And so we're going to start alternating our episodes going forward. We're going to do it so that we continue to give you a 60-minute episode with a guest where we'll talk about their experiences with horror and give you a nice insight into the industry and into their upbringing as a horror fan. And we're going to start intermingling those, alternating those with 30-minute episodes where Donato and I do a little bit of a deeper dive into a particular film. It could be a new release. It could be a release from a few years ago. But something that excites us, that we want to talk about, that we think is going to be right in line with the types of things that you're already hearing about on the podcast or on the website. And we just like giving ourselves a little bit more flexibility to kind of engage with the type of horror that we like talking about, that we want to be thinking about, that we want to shine a spotlight on. But maybe, yes, maybe there's a few other people looking for out there.
And to confirm, once again, just so everyone understands moving forward, that doesn't mean we're going to alternate in the sense that once a month you are getting a regular episode, quote unquote, and then once a month you are getting a just me and Monocle episode. That will be two and two. So once again, the regular episodes will go forward as we're doing them. We're going to stay on top of that. And that will always be the priority. Like this podcast we do to spotlight other voices. We just kind of want to have a little fun on the side. So we're going to stick to a much shorter format for our episodes and just sandwich them in between the real meat of the content that we're producing. And if you don't want that, don't worry. We'll label them very clearly so you don't have to listen to them, and you can just wait for the next week for scheduled programming.
So let me ask you, Donato, because we talked about this a little bit offline or online, off mic. There we go. We're hosting a podcast. We talked about this a little bit off mic, and this is kind of our first chance to pick each other's brain a little bit about the nuts and bolts of this. How do you feel about a 30-minute episode runtime? Because I have some really strong feelings about that. And my strong feelings is that I love shows like Pop Culture Happy Hour, and I think they get it really right when it comes to 15, 20 minutes, about a single thing. They really give you what you were looking for. You know, my wife, who doesn't listen to any film podcasts, after she watches something, will go listen to a Pop Culture Happy Hour episode about a film like Civil War, or whatever else is currently released, because she likes sort of the bite-sized consumable. It's the drive time podcast length, right? Like the commute from the movie theater back home. So I'm clearly in favor of it, but I'm curious, are there anything that you listen to or that you love that also falls in that like under half an hour mark?
So here's the thing, as a podcaster and a podcaster for a few years now, I don't really listen to podcasts. I'm going to be straight up honest with you, because I hear some people say they listen to them on their drive to work. Well, I work at home. I don't have that time. Other people listen to them like on the treadmill or something. Well, now I kind of just either take my run outside, and that is me listening to something very upbeat and honestly, probably Electric Callboy and other types of metal that keeps me going really, with that rhythm. So I don't want to say I don't have the time, but at the end of the day, I kind of don't. Like, I don't have that time to sit down and listen to somebody talk about a movie for, like you just said, an hour and a half, versus all the stuff I have to create during the day, all the things I have to do. So yeah, I struggle with the idea that podcasts are long, I guess to say, and a lot of them are, like most are. So what you're talking about, the idea of having something bite-sized, I haven't really seen much of that, if I'm being completely honest. So yeah, I am enticed by that, because we said when we started our podcast at the beginning of it, 60 minutes was that sweet spot. And do we go over sometimes? Absolutely. If the conversation directs that.
Every time? Have we ever not gone over?
But like going over is by like 5 minutes, yeah, 10 minutes. True. So like we do try to keep it as close to 60 as possible. And you're right, we do often go over, but I believe that 60 minutes is a sweet spot. But what you're describing as like a 30 minute, 45 minute, that sounds way better to me, because if you watch our live stream with me and Perry Demeroff, some of the best stuff we do are little breakouts. We'll cover many topics in that hour, but the most attention will be on like a 15-minute conversation about the last week was basically we did a conversation about Immaculate and The First Omen, because she loved Immaculate and hated The First Omen. I was the reverse. I loved The First Omen and hated Immaculate. So we just had a 15-minute conversation sandwiched in some stupidity on both sides otherwise. But that's to your point. Like that conversation was 15 minutes. We got everything we wanted to say in there. We got in and out. We didn't belabor it. And that is a, I think a lot of other, I don't know, a lot of people could benefit from being more succinct and slow, because I'm not going to lie, I've been on a few podcasts that I didn't realize were 2.5 hours. And I'm like, oh, that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, I look, I get it. You know, every podcast, hopefully every podcast, especially the types, you know, that are similar to ours in terms of talking about film, it begins as, you know, one or two or more friends getting together to talk about movies, right? That's the impetus of it. So when you're connecting with somebody else who's a friend of yours, as well as somebody else whose opinions you respect and who's in the industry, you know, like, certainly you're going to err on the side of running a little bit long, right? Like, when I talk about movies with somebody, I'm not like, all right, guys, like, 5 minutes tops, let's move on, right? Those conversations are long lasting and in depth. So I understand that mentality. But, you know, I think that there, like, the jokes of, like, you know, every white guy having a podcast about a topic matter, like, it's true. We all do. I mean, to give you an example, I've been in this, I'll say fantasy baseball. I've been in this fantasy baseball league for 20 years now, with kind of like me and a few other people. And there's like a rotating group of people that are in it. And a couple of the new guys this past year, or guys that came in within the last 2 years, they get really excited about it. And we're like, oh, like, I want to do, like, we're going to create a podcast about our league, not about the players, which is, if you know the league I'm talking about, it's fake. It's like Madden 20 years in the future kind of thing. These aren't real players. But like not in any kind of like meaningful way. Like, it is literally a podcast that exists for the 20 people that are in this league. Nobody else would understand it. Nobody else would have any frame of reference for it. And their episode's like an hour and a half. And I'm just like, if this is not, God bless, but if this was not the time for you to practice a little bit of brevity when you made a podcast for literally 20 people, then like, I don't know what to tell you. So there's a quote that I always say at work, at my day job, that drives people crazy when I do, but it's my favorite quote on writing ever, and I repeat it constantly. And that is a Mark Twain quote that goes, "I'm sorry I wrote you such a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one." Anything worth saying is worth saying in half the amount of time you think.
Yeah, and that's something I have to think a lot about when I write. That is one of my own critiques. That is a critique that has been given to me by editors. I know that about me. I need to be better about brevity and be better about that stuff. And I have become that over the years. Like, that is the one thing that's gotten trained out of me, and the one thing that editors have like harped on just to get me in a better practice, is those run-ons, those like, we can get through this thought with 10 commas and 4 em dashes, like, right, like, we mm-hmm. can do this. And mm-hmm. no, just simple, sweet, to the point, get it done. And that has benefited me in so many ways. And again, like my comments before too, like, I don't begrudge long podcasts. Like, I've had a great time being on them too. Like, it's, and I will keep doing them. It's just a thing for me where I'm never thinking about it and expecting it. And I know other people enjoy it, so obviously they're listening to it. So, like, that's a good thing. Like, absolutely be doing what works for you and what you think. In my mind, though, I just can't get past it. Like, it's the same thing of, like, I have to choose between watching a movie or listening to a podcast and stuff like that. Yeah. So it's an unfortunate choice, obviously. Again, it's dumb. I wish I could listen to podcasts while I worked, if I was being honest. But the idea, for some reason, music works for me. I can listen to lyrics and not be bothered. But when I'm listening to my friend's podcasts while I'm trying to work, I'm hearing their words while trying to like write an email or focus over here on spreadsheets. And I can't do the two. I don't know why podcasts won't work for me, but music can.
Yeah. No, I'm the same. I can never listen to podcasts while I'm working. Let me ask you though, because again, we're still hammering out the details on what kind of parameters we want to put into place for the horror derbs, or whatever you want to call them. Is there kind of like a type of movie that we can't talk about, or that we wouldn't talk about? We can talk about whatever we want, that we wouldn't talk about under the certain the current model, that you're excited to dive into a little bit more during these sort of shorter Matt on Matt episodes?
Yeah, I think just more popular stuff, because going back to that example I gave before, like, Perry and I had a great conversation about being polar opposites on a very popular topic. Civil War, again, like, I, you know, reading your stuff and seeing your quotes for the movie Civil War, I want to talk to you about that, because it is a very divisive film. And I think we align in a way on things that a lot of other people don't. So we have, to me, I love our podcast. I want to say that, number one, Certified Forgotten. I think we have a brilliant concept, and I'm going to do that until the movies don't exist anymore. So, like, that is my stance on our actual podcast. but it is what you said before. We have pigeonholed ourselves into talking about movies that no one else hears about, that no one else knows about. And the social media, the way people engage now and the way that people find movies is no longer the same as even like 5 or 6 years ago when I could tweet about something that was lesser known. And the algorithm wouldn't just bury it immediately because it wasn't trending or what was like in vogue at the time. So not only are we trying to do this, I don't want to say noble act, but not only are we trying to like highlight movies that we think deserve it and our guests really want to champion, but doing so now in a space that is completely run by an algorithm that dictates what is popular. And I can guarantee you like an 80s snooker vampire musical is not something that the algorithm gives a shit about. So while I adore what we do and will never stop doing it because I think it is important and I want to keep building what we do to a point where, I don't know, hopefully more people do catch wind and hopefully more people do discover our backlog and start finding movies. Like it's so dumb because there's a Letterboxd list of certified forgotten titles that somebody discovered. And it's one person, but I don't give a shit. Like, that's so cool. Like, somebody's discovering movies by listening to us. But I do want to talk about things that are relevant in lesser terms, let's say.
Yeah, I think that there's, I mean, obviously new releases is a big piece of that. And I don't want to step on Perry's toes because The Merry Hour is fucking worth its weight in gold. And the two of you have some excellent conversations on there. So I will get the dregs. I will get what's left over. I understand that.
There's no dregs.
It's not a competition.
But we can have the same conversation, though, and it be completely different. And that is also what I find engaging as well. I like to talk to multiple people about the same things and have completely different opinions and completely different conversations about them. I think that is what's interesting. Like when I write my reviews, I write them from a mindset of I am setting up a conversation for later. So when you read my review, I want you to like think about things and react to them in your own way. I don't want to tell you. I mean, yes, I want to tell you if you're going to like a movie or not, but I also want to make you think about a movie and I want to hear what you said about it. So like, that's always how I'm approaching it.
Yeah. But I think that the, you know, new releases are going to be a good opportunity for us to dig a little bit more. And I think that there's a lot of films that, you know, it's like it may not fit the criteria based on the number of reviews, but there's a lot of stuff that comes out on even a platform like Shudder, but certainly platforms like Netflix and stuff that are just a little bit buried and you can kind of feel, or maybe stuff that we see at a festival and we want to talk about Oddity, right? Like Oddity is a really fun film and it's going to be one of the horror movies of the year in terms of, you know, probably something that'll show up on everybody's list. Like we can have that conversation. I think that would be great. But I'm sure that there, you know, just as I have a list of things that I can't believe you haven't seen, you also have a list of movies you can't believe I haven't seen that are going to fall more in the line of like, oh, this is a great topic for a 30-minute one-off rather than like, oh, you know, let's try and hamstring it into some guest appearance, you know, because that's not, I don't ever want to loosen. You know, we joke about as part of inflation, we'll probably gradually open the reins a bit for folks over time, going from 10 episodes or 10 reviews to 15 reviews to whatever over time. But like part of the fun of that is the digging that our guests do, the fact that they go back and they have to like go through there and they're like, I was looking at this one, but it had 12 reviews and I was looking at that one. Like we love talking about those stories online. So we're going to keep them, you know, we're going to keep them a little bit tighter and we're going to loosen things up a bit for ourselves because, hey, we're the bosses. And what's the point of being the bosses if you can't, you know, bend the rules to favor yourself?
And like we can play a little bit like certified almost forgotten in our episodes, because when you think about it, even something like 20 or 30 reviews for a movie is still low, I would say. What's the threshold for actually getting certified fresh? I think it's 40 reviews is the minimum, I believe. So like maybe that could be like, you know, again, not a rule, but like if we're going to talk about a movie for an episode that is lesser known and we just want to dredge up, we could do it like, oh, like did it actually get accredited, quote unquote? Does it have enough reviews for the threshold? So that's there forever. But I think it's just an opportunity for us to. We always like to shine the spotlight and we'll continue to, because that's why we do the website. That's why we do the podcast. But we could be a little selfish sometimes and, you know. Maybe people might find that they like more of our opinions than we know. You know, who knows?
Yeah. And hey, hopefully we're the through line in all of this. So if you've liked us talking to other guests, then you'll probably like us talking to each other. And honestly, as I think you're going to see in this episode, again, is a good kind of a pivot. If it's just an Ottawa and I talking, we might be a little more transparent with each other in terms of our opinions and thoughts on stuff than we would be with a guest. There are times I haven't liked our guests' movies, and I have let them know I'm not being dishonest, but I might double down if I don't like a movie that Donato brought me in a way that I wouldn't if it was somebody from our community and our network a bit.
Yeah, we can have a whole Oz Perkins conversation one day and see how that goes.
Hell yeah. Yeah. For one of the episodes where it's mine, I'm going to have you watch We Are the Pretty Things That Live in the House, and you'll be unhappy, and I'll be a little unhappy because that's a very slow movie, even by my standards. And it'll just be 30 minutes of dead air. You'll say something mean, I'll say something mean. We won't say anything for 10 more minutes, and then we'll sign off.
I would call out sick from that one, or I would force a replacement. I will never watch that movie again, and that is the episode right now. We could just get that episode done with now. I'm never watching that movie again. Fuck that movie, one of the most boring things I've ever seen.
All right, well, we do have, thanks to our Slack channel, we do have Amelia volunteering to pinch hit as either of us if need be. So she can do a mean Donato and a mean Monocle if need be, and we'll just bring her. We'll bring her in as the understudy whenever possible.
And we can also do fun things too with the 30-hour format of just having a forum. Sometimes, like I'm just thinking out loud right now, yeah. Where if we don't want to do just us every once in a while too, it could be like, hey, let's have a conversation about video game adaptations, or blah blah blah, blah, or like. Some kind of topic. I know I was talking to Shapiro at, I think it was Brooklyn Horror, and he thinks it'd be really cool to have a conversation with a few distributors and kind of just talk about the state of indie distribution. Because what we're talking about a lot is, okay, well, how does this movie get discovered? And I mean, like, Shapiro is on the end of that. Like, Henderson yeah. is on the end of that. Like, we already know a bunch of people in distribution, both physical and theatrical, that are trying to fight the good fight. So like, again, just off the top of my head, we could have a conversation about just that.
Yeah. But I mean, Henderson's probably going to talk a lot about the difficulty in having some of these movies discovered when it turns out all you need to do is, you know, have one of your movie celebrities talk to Letterboxd about how much they like the Dancing Vampire movie that you released. So I think he's overselling the difficulty of the industry a bit.
I can't believe that little weirdo Dan Stevens was like, oh yeah, Norway, one of the best vampire movies I've ever seen. Like, when did Dan Stevens see Norway? That's what I want to know, because that movie played like two festivals in 2014 and it didn't get released until 2021 on Terrorvision. So how, or Vinegar Syndrome, whoever got to do yeah. it, Henderson was the one that nailed it. I just want to know how that happened.
Yeah, this world is a better place for Dan Stevens having been in it. All right. Well, I think that kind of sets the stage for what's going to happen. So this is going to be a bridge episode in terms of length, too. We're going to try and keep it under 60 minutes for this episode because we can. And we made a bunch of jokes at the top of the hour about how we didn't need to. And so, you know, hey, fuck us if we can't keep our promises. But we are going to talk about a film. We do have a film today that the two of us are going to discuss. And then the next time that you see in the feed a solo episode, a Donato and Monocle episode, odds are it's going to be 30 minutes. We're going to be talking about a specific new release or a specific title that we're excited to shine a light on, and we'll give you a little bit of balance that way. You know, if you don't like the longer episodes, then you can jump in on the shorter ones. If you don't like the shorter episodes, you can stick with the longer ones. We're giving you options. We're all about buffet style podcasting here at Shea Certified Forgotten. And on that note, we're going to step away for a second, and when we come back, Donato and I are going to have a conversation about Under the Bed. We'll be right back. Hey everyone, thanks for listening. Just a reminder that if you would like to, you can go to patreon.com/certifiedforgotten to sign up for either our free newsletter, or maybe, if you're feeling charitable, to throw a couple of bucks our way every month. As a reminder, all of the proceeds that we get from our Patreon go directly to our writers and making sure that we can add slots to our editorial calendar each and every month. So your money is accounted for and reported on in Patreon every single month. Thank you so much for listening. Now back to the show. All right, welcome back. So this week, for our pivot episode, Donato brought me a movie that he was very excited to talk about, a movie that he described as, quote, a Donato movie, which if you listen to the podcast, you you know what that means. And yes, it does deliver in all the ways that you would expect. So, quick plot synopsis for you. After 2 years of homeschooling and therapy sessions, teenager Neil returns home, still haunted by the violent episodes that cost him the life of his mother. But reunited with his younger brother, Polly, Neil realizes that his childhood memories, those of sleepless nights and a creature under the bed, were all too real. Now Neil and Polly must join forces to protect their family from the demons out to get them. Directed by Stephen C. Miller of the Silent Night, Deadly Night remake fame, Under the Bed premiered at the Fantasia Film Festival in 2012 before a home video release in 2013. And for those that like to watch the movie before you listen to the episode, it is now streaming on Tubi, our good friends and should-be sponsors at Tubi. So, Donato, you get to answer the question that we always ask of our guest, which is, what'd you bring this episode on the podcast?
I know, this is fun. Usually I have to sit here and wait for someone to answer this before I get to jump in. But yeah, why did I bring this to the podcast? Because as I was describing before, I have my list of movies that I would love to cover someday on the podcast. And it's a list that I give to some of our guests who don't have one on the top of their head. And Under the Bed is one of the first ones on that list. So just giving the history of me as a critic and why I brought this to the podcast. Well, it's one of the first movies I think I've ever reviewed. And it's definitely one of the first... I want to say it's one of the first Stephen C. Miller movies I reviewed. I believe this might have come out 1 year after Silent Night. I'm just trying to get my timeline straight with this. Or no, I think the same year actually is Silent Night. So right around the same time. I really did take to Stephen C. Miller's style of horror directing early. And that was a through line through his work and me reviewing his work. And it was one of those weird scenarios where I kind of fell in step with him, where he was getting more opportunities, let's say, to do bigger things and go on and move upward. And I was at the same time. So it was just a really cool parallel. But Under the Bed stands out to me because I liked it a pretty decent deal. And it does not have a favorable Rotten Tomatoes score. I'll be honest with that. I think I'm one of only like two or three positives. Me and Scott Weinberg and Felix Velasquez, if I'm remembering correctly after just looking. But it's right on the threshold of 10 reviews. It's everything that I think our podcast is about. It was one of those 2000s, early 2010s, straight to DVD horror movies that really didn't get a lot of attention. And I really am a sucker for quote unquote gateway horror that takes itself very serious as a horror film. And while Under the Bed might push a little farther than some children might be ready for or some parents might be willing to let their kids watch, at the end of the day, this is teen child-based gateway horror that takes the simplest concept, the boogeyman, the thing under your bed, that fear of what you hear late at night when there's a creak under the floorboard or something, and it turns it into a pretty gruesome creature feature in that third act. And I'm sure we'll talk about the lead-up and some of the more dramatic elements that maybe don't work as well, but for my money, it's a good little monster flick that does a lot of damage as a childhood ruining monster flick.
Let me ask you this, Donato, since you brought it up. Do you remember the first review you ever published?
I'm going to. That is a good question. It was Extraterrestrial by Nacho Vigalondo. And I'm pretty sure I'm saying that title correctly because we talked about it in an interview one time and I just mentioned to him, I was like, you were my first review. Nacho Vigalondo Extraterrestrial. I think that's what it is. Yes. Extraterrestrial. Nacho Vigalondo. That was my first review. I can remember that. Yep.
All right. Mine was, and I count this, when I was in middle school, I wrote into the local alt weekly in Juneau, Alaska, which was the capital city weekly, long since dead. And I convinced them to let me write a review of The Mothman Prophecies, the Richard Gere film that I absolutely remember fuck all about this day. The review exists nowhere. It's not even on the Wayback Machine. That was too far back for, you know, the mid-90s for that to have been a thing. But I feel like I've been chasing that Mothman Prophecies high ever since. Anyways. That's besides the point. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, you said that this was early in your career. This is a film that you saw and reviewed and you're kind of judging it within an artist's body of work. How much does that play a part in hindsight for you, a film within a series of films that you can sort of, you know, call it auteur theory, call it just like, you know, your ability to like recognize patterns, recognize themes and growth and things like that. Do you find yourself remembering films more favorably if they exist as part of an overall body of work you like more? Does that not matter to you at all? Tell me what you think.
Yeah, it's interesting because looking back on Stephen C. Miller's career now, so as I was experiencing it is one thing, is what you just said. I'm kind of experiencing it in real time. But looking back on the body of work, he was a horror director for a while. The Aggression Scale is kind of what put him on the map. He's done plenty of other films. And then he started getting into more, straight to video action films. He got to work with like Bruce Willis and just a list of other cast members of, you know, just got to blow shit up and have fun action sequences for a while. And I've really got to direct Nick Cage.
If you get to direct Nick Cage, you're golden in my book.
Exactly. So like exactly that kind of career. And I, you know, no qualms against it. Like go out there and make your money. Like he just cranked movies out. He was always working and that's great. But I forever wanted him to return to horror, because if I look at his body of work in the horror sphere specifically, he's a really good director at taking not a lot of means and producing something which I think, this is my opinion obviously, but I think he does a really good job of producing something that feels bigger than the production actually is. Silent Night is absolutely an example of that. It is a really nasty, gruesome slasher. It's also, you know, not the most highly budgeted slasher at the same time. And I think he achieves so much atmosphere and so much, especially like Christmas horror. That is such a cool thing to deliver. Mm-hmm. And he goes above and beyond to really put that through. And Under the Bed for me really drives that home. The idea that he takes a simple concept and can go above and beyond and really pound those practical effects in the last half. Like, this is a dude who appreciates the right things about horror cinema. And what you can always expect from his movies is something that's going to go practical, that's going to honor those old school special effects, because it's all there in this movie and it's not hiding what it wants to be. There's no softness. There's no kind of tiptoeing around the boogeyman scenario. And I don't know. I just really appreciate that. I think Miller is a filmmaker who isn't going to cheat you as a horror fan. And do I wish he had bigger budgets? Do I wish he was given opportunities and got that vault, let's say, to like this mainstream studio status that other directors have? Like, yeah, I would love to see what he can do with all the money in the world. But at the same time, am I thoroughly impressed with him as an indie filmmaker to this point and like the career he has thrown together? Hell yeah, like 100%. I'm here for it too. Like, you know my style, you know what I like. Like, this is kind of my type of horror.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the movie, and I'll get some of my opinions on the board here too. I think that this feels to me, and it's sort of an oversimplistic thing to say, but it sort of feels to be like a short that was turned into a feature, in the sense that there is a really fun and visceral last 10 minutes or so, and then a kind of a lot of build up to get to that point, which is fine. You're allowed to take as much time as you want with your movie. It's your movie, right? But I think that there are those flashes of what you talk about on display. There's a shot early in the film that I was really struck by, which is where the main character is walking into his house for the first time since he's returned. And it's a really, really simple shot, which is just him sort of like slowly walking in from the lawn through like the French double doors or whatever they are. And the camera changes the ratio a little bit so that like when he's right at the doorway, it feels like this huge, all-encompassing, yawning maw that he's stepping into. And then the camera pulls back into the hallway and everything shrinks and narrows down, where it gives you this sense of claustrophobia for the character too. There are a couple of times where, you know, the visuals, sort of the ideas that Miller is playing with as a director, work at that level. They're inexpensive, they're smart, they use the best of kind of what you have in terms of material. I think this movie gets, you know, an A+ from high school fog machine managers everywhere, and you know, its ability to take those and turn those into turn a fog machine into, you know, another character in the film. It's like New York is a character in a movie, the fog machine is a character in this movie, you know what I mean? But I will say that, like, even for me, I think that it did strike me a bit as there being a lot of dead air in the middle of the movie. And I think that that's just, you know, I'm kind of of two minds about it, right? One, especially if you're going to go hard in the end, we'll talk about that in a minute. If you're, it needs to feel like the accentuation point on something that is building to that. I don't know if that was necessarily kind of what I felt from Under the Bed. But I also recognize the fact that, like, if, you know, if you're working with a modest budget, if you're working with a cast of actors that may not be, you know, hugely well known and aren't certainly going to be the kind of people that, you know, the sort of folks that, God bless, but like film critics are going to get that email in their inbox and kind of move along to the next thing a little bit. I totally respect and understand the fact that you're going to shoot what you can do, which is a lot of character development and a lot of like story stuff. And there's some good performances in this movie. I think that Gatlin Griffith, who plays the younger brother, Polly, is actually the best actor in the movie. I think he delivers the most nuanced performance out of everybody in the film, which is really impressive. But there are times where the movie's ability to overcome its limitations and time where the movie kind of like steered into the limitations. There were moments where that balance just wasn't quite right for me.
Yeah, and I read back some of my review that I wrote at the time, and definitely echoing exactly what you said, there are some slower pacing moments because for as much as this movie wants to take its time to get to that payoff of an ending, and by gosh, the payoff is great, you know, it does feel like a pretty traditional family drama with some overplayed elements from a father who just flies off the handle to basically drive home the point that these boys are on their own. And he can be overbearing, but again, like, you know, there are terrible family circumstances elsewhere. So, you know, I'm not discounting that by any means, but you know, for the way the movie is structured, it does feel like some of the I'm just a kid vibes and those childhood moments trying to drum up some drama between more than awkwardness, you know, whether that's young love or something like that. It feels a tad bit shoehorned. I'm not going to argue that. Like, this is a movie that takes its time to get there. But for me, it's weighing the equation of taking its time to get there and then getting there. And maybe I'm viewing it from a point of seeing so many movies that take their damn time and don't have the payoff that deserve it. So when I see a movie like Under the Bed that actually has that third act that deserves your patience, I might be a little more, let's say, forgiving, and maybe rate it a little higher, because I am not expecting a child to have its head twisted around and ripped off. Like, right. And that kick off the final act, that moment, the first time I saw it, I like jaw drop a little bit. And I'm like, holy crap, they're not only are they going there, but that is the kickoff to the finale. So there's still so much more left to do with the monsters, the remaining family members, and how that plays out. So for me, no argument on it. I agree with you. I do think there is a little bit too slow of a buildup, but I'm still able to be carried through with the little eerie moments leading up to the big payoff. I mean, the bed scene for me is so cool when the bed basically turns into a monster. A+. I want more of that.
Yeah, weirdly, I think my favorite scene in the film is the I wrote down pretty much everything he said because it was so delightful. The theater director scene, the one where Polly falls asleep, that kind of kicks off, you know, him staying at home and moves the movie into sort of its final phase. There's this really bizarre, kind of delightful sequence, shades of Donnie Darko, where Patrick Swayze's character is kind of presenting in the auditorium there. But they have, you know, Polly is one of the kids who's in the theater class, and the drama teacher is lamenting the low turnout for this year's play, you know, takes a shot at the across the bow of the school board for cutting their funding. And he has a line that I loved, which was, you can thank your parents for responding so well to the original piece I wrote, Barry Bonds, Hero or Cheater. I was like, all right, this is definitely the time period when this was released. Yep. I get it. But it was also just like, I wish the movie had, because the movie is so focused on the home life with the characters, but because sort of those relationships can only ever progress to a point, right? Because like the whole point of the story is that they're sort of frozen in time with this thing that happened 2 years ago. I wanted a little bit more flavor of the outside world. And I wish that they'd kind of embrace that a little bit more, because those sorts of scenes show that, like, you know, my favorite moments in any movies are sort of like the oddball cast of characters that you sort of bumble and stumble up against over the course of a movie. And I think that there was more opportunity to spend a little bit to maybe have a little bit more robust of a supporting cast. I totally respect the focus on really what is just basically like a four-hander in terms of four main characters, and that's the film. And then those freaky neighbor kids who just sort of suck. But, you know, I do, you know, I wanted a little bit of the absurdity to leak through in other ways. I think and it doesn't have to be a horror comedy, but a lot of good horror can sort of underpin the extremeness of the central scenario by kind of like having little absurd moments pop up around it, which doesn't take away from that main thing, but like gives you a moment to be like, oh yeah, this is real fun. Like, this is a grown ass adult who's trying to figure out how to, you know, fight a monster under his bed that's about to take his little brother. Those are the kind of things that I think might have pepped up that middle section a little bit more. I do have to say, I would have rather watched the Barry Bonds Hero or Cheater show for sure, or The Crucible the musical, the other show that he's working on. Those both sound like winners.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll counterpoint a little bit in the sense where I will agree that it does feel like we are being trapped in the house with the two brothers, because they are the main focus. That is the whole point of this. It's about brothers coming together and having to defeat the monster that tore their family apart. Amazing message. That is good. We like that. But you can feel stuck in the sense where it's like, okay, these brothers are going to get locked in the room again somehow. Like, why are we doing this? How are we doing it again? The one thing I'll come back with is I feel like in a lot of horror movies, the step parent is always like the sacrifice. It's the step parent is never going to be as important as the blood family. And here it is quite the opposite. And I liked that. I like the idea that you can have the successful through line of being the stepmother or stepfather, and not only helping, but being the one who saves the day. I'm not used to seeing that. And I it was, again, something that struck me when I saw it the first time. And I'm like, huh, this is trying something different. And I like that.
I did appreciate that quite a bit. I also like the fact that Polly's instincts are sort of proven out over the course of the film, which is another trope that a lot of these movies fall into, which is like the kids are stupid, you know, God bless. But like in every kind of killer movie, you know, or not killer movie, but you know, these types of films where there's something that only a kid can see that is sort of like preying on them and their family. They sort of require a lot of the times for that child character to either be completely powerless or like completely, you know, delusional in terms of what they think is going to happen. And I think that I respect a film. You know, my wife always knows that one of the things that I always rant about after watching a movie, the best thing that a movie can do, the worst thing that a bad movie can do, is I like it where movies have their characters do the right thing and it doesn't matter. Like, don't have them make bad decisions, have them make the right decision and then show us that the right decision didn't matter in the end. What was going to happen was still always going to happen. And I think this film does a really good job of sort of showing these characters that are like, yes, you can trust your parents, right? Like, yes, you want to, you know, your parents are going to be loving. And in some of the cutaways that we spend with the boys' parents, stepmom and dad, you know, we get a sense that they really do care and they're not just being evil or stupid or cruel. But the movie makes it pretty clear, like, you can't tell them that there's a monster under your bed, you know, if for no other reason than you're dealing with some pretty significant trauma over the loss of their mother. And that shit is going to get you sent off to Florida and staying with an aunt and homeschooled and institutionalized a little bit. So the movie gets by. It has characters make the right decisions and then it shows that it doesn't matter. And I did really like that about it.
Yeah. For me, this is kind of on the same level as something like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark or another brand of gateway horror that goes right for the jugular. Like I like gateway horror that endangers children and actually lets them be characters versus these protected, you know, sacred heroes, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's great to show. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, we should be showing children types of media that shows what they can become and the hero they can be. But at the same time, like, the world is a scary fucking place. And, like, there's so much to showing that in all of its vile and repulsive glory through, like, horror cinema. Where I really like how Miller doesn't downplay what is on screen just to appease certain elements. Like, we know the demographic for this movie is probably going to be a lot of hardcore horror fans, but you know, how many hardcore horror fans are going to watch a movie about kids at the same time? So then all of a sudden, like, kids become more of a demographic. And this is one of those really good entry points that is like, hey, horror can be fun and goopy and scary and all these things and still be about things you relate to. And that is a very cool thing, because once again, like, there's some cool techniques that Miller uses, you know, like these. We got that third act and the monster's running around and there's like Spielbergian lens flares in the background and things like that. Like, he's bringing these sci-fi elements in from classic films. And I think that's just, you know, a creative filmmaker touch, where this is a dude who just loves movies so much and he wants to shout out all the ones that he really loves, like the ones he's passionate about, and replicate them a little bit. But there's no sacrificing a vision. And I really think that's good. Maybe bad in some ways, and that's why this movie might not have been widely seen. Maybe a more PG-13 version could have struck more of a chord somewhere else. But, you know, the fact that he got to make this movie, and I think, you know, writing by Eric Stoltz as well, they both made their movie in the way that they wanted to, and I can't fault them at the end of the day. Like, this is the straightforward horror film that I would love to show to kids who were ready for that or who were craving that.
Yeah, I like that you brought up the child violence thing. I was reading, there's a really good piece on Polygon this past week, which was digging into, in the first two versions of Fallout, the video game series Fallout 1 and Fallout 2, there was a perk you could get called Child Killer, which you would get. It was basically like an achievement, but it would happen to you, like a negative penalty, if you killed multiple child NPCs over the course of your playthrough. And there, the feature on Polygon is this this sort of oral history of the rejected perk design, which has some notoriety online, is the vault boy kicking a pregnant woman in the stomach was something that they had entertained as like a graphic that they would share, and then rightly got rid of it, but it surfaced a few years later online and has just been sort of like this myth thing. They went and found the original artist and he was like, I have no fucking clue what I was thinking. Like, I like the violence thing. The violence thing is fun. And you're right, like, kids should be able to die in movies. Because that, you know, I'd rather a kid die than a dog die in a movie, which is a true statement, but just sort of generally, it's nice to show that you are not going to, you're not going to limit yourselves in terms of chasing set pieces, right? Like, we all want the best possible gore sequences we can. And as much as any kid in a horror film deserves it, the kids that die in this movie fucking deserve it. They suck so much. Like, yeah, I was rooting for them to die. I was very happy when they did. So like, all of that works really well for me. And I think you're right. Like, they absolutely, like, the last 10 minutes of the movie, you know, multiple decapitations, right? Like multiple like head crushing. This is on par with, you know, any horror movies that I've seen in terms of bodily violence, like really, really going for it, really swinging for the fences. And I think there's a part of it too, Donato, that is like, I do feel like, especially with movies, we tend to remember that last 10 minutes, and that tends to shape it, to shape the entire experience we have, right? Like, I think that, you know, I did not like this movie as much as you, and I'm glad to see that you still like it as much on a rewatch as you did back when. But I think there's something to be said for those movies that end on a high violent note. And then, you know, people are like, you go back and watch it and you're like, yeah, maybe it's not as good as it, but I remember where it's going. And so the whole time I'm just like, let's go, let's get violent. Like, I do feel like those movies are, I remember those favorably. If it has a really kick-ass 10 minutes, I can watch an entire movie for an hour and 20 and be like, oh man, I really didn't like this movie. And if they stick the landing, I'm like, all right, okay, hey, yeah.
Yeah, this is a big stick the landing for me, for that exact reason. I said before, I'm comparing it to other films of that ilk. I think I've said on the podcast before that as much as you can win me over with a proper payoff, you can lose me so quickly with one that does not cut the mustard. Like, that's, I need my payoff to be there. If you string me along for 80 something minutes and you give me 5 minutes of not that great, I'm going to come down hard on you. Like, that's just where it is.
What was the Shudder film from a few years ago? Like the power outage film about this woman.
Yeah.
Who works
I know what you're talking about. Mm-hmm.
For 85 minutes, maybe one of the best horror films I've ever seen. For 5 minutes. There's no worse feeling in the world than when a movie like has it all and then just like can't walk away from the table and like keeps going that little bit that sort of ruins the vibe. And you're just like, oh my God, why? Just like, just 5 minutes earlier, just like literally at any point, just yell cut and then just print. And the movie there is better than the ending that you put together. I'm still mad about that. I'm still so sad about that film.
Yeah. And to your credit though, or to like, to what you're saying, it is something I acknowledged in the first time. Like I acknowledged the fact that it does take a while to get there. So, you know, looking back on how that has changed over time, I watched the movie I knew I watched the first time. Like I didn't have any of those experiences of like, oh, this is slower than I thought. I was like, no, I remember it being a little bit slow like this. That's the ding I knocked on it. And that's definitely what brought my rating down a little bit. But the midnight horror fan in me, like the horror fan who wants all the practical, the horror fan who wants all of that creature feature action, we even get that kind of other realm of the boogeyman realm. Like I don't, it's not really called the boogeyman, whatever monster we want to say this is, but like, yeah, we get this like upside down Vecna kind of like place, and
yeah,
it's all doing what it can, and it's all doing it in a way that shouldn't work for the budget. But when you have a talented filmmaker doing things that they can do and accentuating aspects that other filmmakers probably couldn't accentuate, I am going to be here and I am going to champion that like harder. Like, again, like that's why I brought on here. Like, that's why I brought on the podcast. I want to talk about this movie versus the other ones that, you know, get talked about more, but aren't achieving this. You know, they just have a bigger budget and they're just your typical schlocky fare and cool, great. At the end of the day, I love that, but I don't know, there's people out there doing it like Miller and they're doing it like Under the Bed, and it's not gonna be everyone's favorite movie, but it you know, it's a fun one to watch. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, listen, if your favorite monster of the week in X-Files was the Leech character and you want to see that character in a $10,000 budget version of the Upside Down, you're gonna fucking love the end of this movie. That is what I will say to you.
And like, is it CGI? Is it all these things having to make it work? Like, of course it is. But boy, howdy, I can tell you from seeing other kind of movies in the indie realm of this one, once again, that doesn't mean that it's going to, man, I've seen so many bad iterations of what I just watched again. And it's that, I think, is the biggest point for me. I have seen so many worse iterations of exactly what I saw on that screen an hour ago. And that's what gives me more faith about championing something like Under the Bed.
Well, then it's time for you to answer the question we always ask of our guests. And it's your turn to sit in the hot seat, Mr. Donato, and say, what do you think it will take for this film to surpass, to overcome its certified forgotten status?
It's hard. This is one of those ones that came out, you know, around 2012. It came out late enough where we're starting to get more of the Blu-ray releases and more of the streaming releases and stuff like that. I don't think it's ever been prominently placed on a streamer, so I don't think it's had that push, like a Shudder especially. That is going to be necessary. I also don't think this is going to be first in line for any kind of Vinegar Syndrome or Terror Vision, you know, re-releases. So this one is going to be discovered when you've watch something like Silent Night, when you watch another one of Stephen C. Miller's movies, and maybe you watch one of his action movies and find out he's also a horror director and want to go backward. And I think that is the way to do that. Or if somebody writes an article about the importance of gateway horror, and it also like the importance of gateway horror that treats its characters and audience with the same amount of respect, I think it could get a mention there. It's going to take a lot of marketing, I guess. I didn't want to say marketing, but like, yeah, marketing at the end of the day to bring this one back into focus. And a lot of stars are going to have to align. But if this is the first of many stars, I will take that.
Yeah. And I should say, you've said gateway horror a couple of times. Just for the parents to listen, please note that the end of this film is a Rob Zombie movie. So do not think that by gateway we mean, you know, it is appropriate for 12-year-olds, because it is absolutely not. But it's appropriate for a 14-year-old that probably shouldn't be watching it, is what I'll say. You know, Donato, I will throw one out here that we've never actually used during this segment. And it's a vehicle, a distribution vehicle that I don't think exists anymore. But still, this would have been perfect for those like 3 DVD value packs that you would find at like a Best Buy or a Walmart. This would be like if it's bundled with something, you know, even something a little bit more high profile, like the Babadook or something. If some not the Babadook in particular, but like something of that caliber where somebody's like, yeah, we got the rights to a really good horror movie and we got to round out like, you know, three discs in a package or something like, oh yeah, this is, I've heard good things about this movie, we'll throw it in here. I think that it would have fit in nicely with that. And I know that they still technically do those on streamers, right? Like, I think you can go on like Vudu and buy like five films at a low price type thing. I think it technically exists. But this is where I'll pour one out for those like bundle distribution things, not because they were by the same director or the same studio, but just because they were sort of vaguely thematically linked. And you would be able to, you know, appreciate a couple of movies that might not otherwise be on your radar. I always like those. And sometimes we talk about movies. This is the first time I made that connection. Sometimes we talk about movies and I'm like, ah, oh, would have been a great second or third DVD in like a bundle.
Yeah, like those Eight Scary Tales or those. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's because of the branding on top, and it was like its own programmed film festival just released on DVDs. I think Dance of the Dead and other stuff were part of those. Yeah, I know exactly. The Children. We talk about The Children on this podcast a few times. Yeah, I agree with that. That would have been a nice thing. And if people do those again, that'd be a cool thing to resurface, bringing back those film festival at home kind of releases of, you've never heard of this movie and you know you probably weren't gonna, but hey, it's part of a Scary Stories 8, Scary Stories 9. I don't know.
Somebody will. I mean, and if we think of the way nostalgia works, we're in the middle of like home video nostalgia right now. And eventually we're going to get to the like twilight days of late video nostalgia, which is when distributors were like, oh fuck, we have all this extra surplus. Let's just start throwing things together in value packs. And, you know, putting them together, a blockbuster, three for the price of one deals. I would not at all be shocked. As a matter of fact, I would bet my entire retirement that one of the smaller niche distributor out there, like the Blu-ray or home video things, are going to rediscover that, you know, kind of recreate interest in the bundles. Because that was, for a lot of horror fans, I'm sure that's how they expanded their knowledge, expanded their collection, was through those value packs.
I think Henderson does something along those lines, because Terrorvision is part of like, it's also vinyls. It's also a bigger company. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure they're starting to do in Savannah, Georgia, where their flagship store is, there's going to be Terrorvision festivals. I think there's already been one or two at this point, which will be cool because it's like, yeah, it's Terrorvision movies. And again, those are movies that are largely undiscovered themselves. So I love that idea. I love the idea of, hey, we're releasing a bunch of movies that are pretty rad and you can buy them. Or we're going to put on a little festival once a year and show our favorites. Like, that's cool.
Well, there you have it, everybody. Matt Donato has brought his film, his Certified Forgotten title for us this week. And as we talked about, this is kind of a sneak peek at the format that we will be using more of going forward when we're going to do shorter episodes and talk through movies that we're excited about. So, you know, hopefully, in you being spoiled for so long with all your incredible guests we've been bringing in, you haven't, you know, lost your appetite and attention for just me and my buddy Matt Donato talking about movies the way God intended.
You can tolerate us for a little bit. It's okay.
You can do it. All right, Donato, promote thyself. Where do people follow you online? Where do they go if they want to see what you're working on?
Woof. Sorry, Rogers just barked the minute I unmuted.
Rogers. Oh, we officially have. We'll put him in the episode description. Rogers is the special guest in this week's episode of Certified Forgotten.
Anyway, you can find me at Donatobomb on Twitter, Letterboxd, Instagram. I'll say TikTok. I guess I can throw out Blue Sky too. Those are my big ones. And yeah, got more work coming out as always. There's going to be no shortage of that. So reviews, videos, all that fun stuff. Got more, you know, hopefully do some more IGN reviews, video reviews. Yeah, I don't know. Let's just see where shit goes.
Yeah, kind of getting on camera a little bit there, sir.
Scary. It's weird, but I like it.
It's weird. What do you do with your hands?
I don't know. I don't know.
They don't tell you that. As for myself, you can follow me in all the usual places. I'm trying to be better these days about saying that, you know, Blue Sky Monocle dot blah, blah, blah is where you go if you want to have conversations with me. And then my Instagram is where you go if you want to see what I'm up to, see what I'm watching and what I'm interested in. Trying to stay on top of my letterbox too. These are all the places where we can have little social connections about things that are going on. And of course, if you like what you heard today, then you're probably going to fucking love certifiedforgotten.com and all of the excellent, excellent essays and material we have coming out this month and last month and coming out next month and all that good stuff. So as a reminder, if you follow our Patreon, patreon.com/certifiedforgotten, there's a free tier that will get you our weekly newsletter, as well as occasional updates, you know, things that we think it's worth sharing with y'all. It doesn't cost a darn thing. You want to do it. It's like our Substack, but we just like keeping all of our people in one little place. It's neat and tidy.
But if you wanted to also give money to the Patreon, that'd be fine also too. True.
That's also true. Give us your attention and then give us your money. Doesn't have to be in that order. We're totally fine if you give us money and then just never click on anything ever again. That's cool too.
And by us, I mean give our writers money, because we do not take a cut. I can guarantee that.
Oh, how'd your taxes go?
Better than usual? Anyway.
Okay. All right. It's all good. All right, Donato, take us home.
Boogie, okay.